Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Jordan says Islamic State fighters captured pilot in Syria. And Obama praises Sony's decision to release Kim Jong-un assassination flick. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. Jordan says Islamic State militants have captured one of its pilots after his plane went down in northern Syria during a mission against IS insurgents. The Jordanian army said in a statement Wednesday that it is holding the militants responsible for the pilot's life and safety. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported earlier that Islamic State fighters shot the plane down near Raqqa. As of December 15th, the coalition has conducted about 553 airstrikes. The U.S. President Barack Obama is welcoming Sony Pictures' decision to release a controversial movie about the assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Sony pulled the interview last week after its computers were hacked by unknown attackers who threatened more damage if the film was released as scheduled. The U.S. blamed North Korea for the cyber attack. On Wednesday, Sony reversed its decision to cancel the movie, announcing a limited theatrical release on December 25th. Representatives of Ukraine, Russia, pro-Russian rebels, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe resumed fresh talks Wednesday on a possible settlement of the Ukrainian crisis. The negotiations are focusing on how to solidify a September ceasefire that has reduced the fighting, the pullback of troops and heavy weapons, prisoner exchanges, and the delivery of humanitarian aid to eastern Ukraine. Speaking at a cabinet meeting Wednesday, Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk called upon pro-Russian separatists to execute the Minsk protocols. This is VOA News. Police in northeastern India say at least 52 people have now died after a series of coordinated attacks by suspected tribal separatists. Parts of Assam state remained under curfew Wednesday following the violence there late Tuesday that Prime Minister Narendra Modi called an act of cowardice. And others condemned the attacks, and on a special account, Twitter account, saying such acts of terror and violence must be put down with a firm hand. Authorities have blamed the banned National Democratic Front of Boroland. India has designated the group as a terrorist organization. Police in the state of Missouri say an officer shot and killed an armed black man early Wednesday morning. Spokesman for the police department in Berkeley, a suburb of St. Louis, says the officer encountered two men during a routine check at a gas station. The spokesman says one of the men pointed a gun at the officer, prompting the officer to open fire. The second man fled the scene. The St. Louis Dispatch, Post-Dispatch newspaper, has identified the dead man as 18-year-old Antonio Martin. Australian authorities have arrested and charged two men as part of a wider counter-terrorism investigation, a day after Prime Minister Tony Abbott warned of increased terror chatter. 20-year-old Suleiman Khalid was charged Wednesday with possession of documents designed to facilitate a terrorist attack. A 21-year-old man, whose name was not given, was charged with disobeying a police control order. The arrests were related to a series of police raids in Sydney and Brisbane in September. A total of 11 people arrested in those raids have now been charged with terrorism-related offences. Australian Federal Police Commissioner Michael Phelan says the documents seized from Khalid talked a little about potential government targets in Sydney.
There was enough there that gave concern to us that something was being planned. And that's why a person was charged. He was charged in relation to having a document that was designed to clearly facilitate an attack.
Phelan also said he is confident that authorities have disrupted the planned terrorist activity. And former U.S. President George H.W. Bush has been admitted to a hospital in Houston, Texas. Spokesman for the 90-year-old Bush said the former president was taken to Houston Methodist Hospital after experiencing shortness of breath. The 41st U.S. president and father of former President George W. Bush was admitted to the same hospital in December 2012 for treatment of bronchitis-related cough. President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle vacationing in Hawaii send their good wishes to ailing Bush and the entire family. George H.W. Bush served as president from 1989 to 1993. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, I believe in the principle of accountability for these terrible crimes, and I think if the International Criminal Court was to be eliminated now, that would be a devastating blow for the whole ideal of international justice.
That's Anton Dworkin of the European Council on Foreign Relations speaking on the International Criminal Court. We'll have details coming up. Also, the Somali parliament approved a new prime minister today. Pirates hijacked a naval gunboat on a major waterway in Nigeria's oil-rich Bayelsa state. And an African Union official talks about efforts to guarantee free and fair elections. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Somali parliament approved a new prime minister today, endorsed by an overwhelming margin, the appointment of Omar Abdelrashid Ali Shamarke. He replaces Abdelwahi Sheikh Ahmed, who was deadlocked in a power struggle with President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud for the past month. Shamarke, 54, recently served as Somalia's ambassador to the United States and was prime minister in a transitional administration in 2009 and 2010. The government must now finish a review of a provisional constitution and establish a federal system. The country has for decades survived violent clan rivalries, clashes with jihadists linked to al-Qaeda, and periodic drought and starvation. The International Criminal Court was created to pursue some of the world's most heinous crimes in places unable to deliver justice. No perpetrator is too powerful to face charges at the Hague-based tribunal, or that was the idea. But the collapse of the case against Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and other setbacks are fueling a debate about the ICC's effectiveness and relevancy. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
The appeals chamber, by majority, Chad Song partly dissenting.
A victory for the International Criminal Court. Earlier this month, appeals judges at the Hague Tribunal upheld the conviction of Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga. The sentence closed the tribunal's first ever case, and it brings to three the number of cases the court has concluded since becoming operational in 2002, including one acquittal.
There has been no indication from the representative of the government of Kenya that they intend to adopt any of the measures.
But December is better remembered for the collapse of the prosecution's case against Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. The ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, filed a statement withdrawing allegations against him related to post-election violence in Kenya. She blamed Kenyan authorities of intimidating witnesses and failing to deliver documents the prosecution claims were key in building its case. Today, the Kenyatta case is strengthening debate around a fundamental question. Should the ICC continue to exist? For Anthony Dworkin, a rights specialist at the European Council on Foreign Relations, the answer is yes.
Well, I believe in the principle of accountability for these terrible crimes. And I think if the International Criminal Court was to be eliminated now, that would be a devastating blow for the whole ideal of international justice. So I really would oppose any move to eliminate the ICC.
Many disagree. Critics argue the ICC is influenced not just by justice, but by politics. The United Nations Security Council refers investigations to the ICC, but three of its members, Russia, China, and the United States, are not member states. Critics say its accomplishments, just two convictions in a dozen years, do not justify the hefty costs of running it. And some African leaders claim the court is biased since all those now on trial are African. Steve Lemoyne is senior advisor for the Coalition for the ICC, an international umbrella group. He lists a number of court successes this year, including getting charges confirmed against former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo, whose trial begins next year. He says the court needs the resources and support to do its job effectively, including from its African critics.
The majority of the referrals from these situations in Africa have come from Africa, beyond the referrals by the Security Council and others. As long as there's evidence indicating that they should pursue those cases, I think they should basically do that.
In the Kenyatta case, analyst Workin says the prosecution stretched too far.
To pursue a case against an African head of state without the evidence to sustain the case is really a very unfortunate position to be in, even if it simply relates to the fact that it's hard for the court to build a case against a head of state and a government that's not cooperating, and it's going to be impossible for them to do that without stronger international support.
But this month, the court stepped back when it felt it was not getting that international backing. Chief Prosecutor Bensouda told the UN Security Council she had suspended an investigation into alleged war crimes in Darfur for lack of support from the body. Observers say that is unlikely, since Security Council member China has traditionally supported Sudan. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has an ICC arrest warrant against him for genocide and other charges, claims victory. ICC coalition advisor Steve Lemoine.
The UN Security Council itself seems to be uncommitted and has not taken any action where the government of Sudan itself has failed to cooperate with ICC arresting Omar al-Bashir. So the Security Council needs to take more concrete action in cases where its member states fail to abide by its own resolutions.
In other cases, the tribunal is reaching out. Beyond Africa, current investigations include cases in Colombia, Georgia, Honduras, Iraq, and Ukraine. In Afghanistan, Bensouda says she's looking into the U.S. military's alleged use of so-called enhanced investigation tactics, or torture. Washington is not a signatory of the Rome Statute that established the court, but Afghanistan is. Analyst Dworkin says the Afghanistan example underscores the ICC's fundamental dilemma.
The more it goes after cases which are politically difficult, which are involving major powers like the United States, the less likely it is to achieve results, the more likely it is to provoke the hostility among the big powers. On the other hand, I don't think it's a viable way forward for the court to look like it's simply justice for the weak countries of the world.
The solution, Dworkin says, is not to abolish the court, but to strengthen its ability to do its job properly and to be more realistic about what it can achieve and what it cannot. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 13 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Somalia's parliament approves a new prime minister today. Pirates hijack a naval gunboat on a major waterway in Nigeria's oil-rich Bayelsa state. And an African Union official talks about efforts to guarantee free and fair elections. And for more news and information 24/7, visit our website at www.voanews.com. In more developments around the continent, African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma says the African Union is working with Zimbabwe and other African countries to ensure free and open polls. Speaking with reporter Sandra Naira on a formerly classified report regarding allegations of voter fraud in Zimbabwe's 2002 elections, Dr. Dlamini Zuma said the role of the African Union is not just to police elections in troubled countries, but also to help offer solutions.
Our responsibility should not be just police to say, oh, this one has done wrong, but it's to say, how can we ensure that in Africa our elections are credible, they are transparent, they also take into account concerns of the opposition parties and so on. And all along, people were saying, oh, the AU will always say the ruling party has won. We were in Malawi recently. We didn't say that. We observed. And we said the party that won, won. It wasn't the ruling party. Because our ultimate objective is that elections in Africa should be democratic, should be free, should be transparent. So we work with countries to try and make them like that, so that in future that mistake does not happen.
In terms of the Zimbabwe elections, following the agreement between the AU, SADC and Zimbabwe as we go towards 2018 elections, you know, what role is the AU playing in ensuring that all that complicates elections is dealt with in terms of the media, electoral reforms, and all those issues that were pointed out by the AU and the SADC?
Well, what we are doing even now is to follow up on those things. Some of the things are in the law. For instance, the issue of airtime on television and all that radio. In Zimbabwe, it's in the law. They are supposed to get equal time given by the Electoral Commission. But the law also says any political party can over and above buy airtime if it so wishes. So I think it's very important to really be objective and look at what the law says. And if the law is wrong, then it's up to the Zimbabwean parliament to look at that. But at the moment, the law says the Electoral Commission should give equal time, which they say they did. But in addition, the law says any party can buy more time. This time, I think ZANU-PF bought a lot of time because we saw a lot of them on the air. In the previous election, the MDC appeared a lot more. Maybe they had more airtime because they bought more. So if that's the law, then if people are dissatisfied, then the AU can't change the law. But the country must then say, okay, maybe you're not allowed to buy airtime. But in all elections, even in Western countries, people do buy airtime. So we are working with all the countries, not only Zimbabwe, but in all the countries, we always observe that this can still be improved, that can still be improved, whether it's in Malawi, whether it's in Zimbabwe, whether it's where. So we are working with those countries, and we hope that by their next election, those elections will be better than the previous ones.
That's African Union Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma speaking with reporter Sandra Naira. The UN Special Envoy for Libya has announced that rival militias battling for control of Tripoli, Benghazi, and eastern oil fields have agreed in principle to peace talks next month. Bernardino Leon told the UN Security Council that talks are set for January 5th. Libyan Prime Minister Mohamed Darieri also told a session of the Security Council earlier that his government, which is working from temporary quarters in the port city of Tobruk, remains committed to talks but warned that resolution of conflicts between multiple rival militias will be difficult. A rival Islamist government was established in Tripoli when Libya Dawn militias attacked the capital and occupied most government buildings. Human rights violations may be a major challenge for peace talks. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said yesterday that militias have conducted indiscriminate shelling of civilian populations and has forced the evacuation of more than 100,000 people. Dairie also said his government in Tobruk is running out of operating funds and has no access to revenues from the North African country's vast oil fields. Islamist militias opposed to the Tobruk government have seized Libya's two biggest oil export ports. Fighting has since spread to a third oil port. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Malawi, the management for a Jacaranda School of Orphans in the commercial capital Blantyre recently hosted a Christmas party for its students. The party marked closure of the school for Christmas and New Year holidays. BOA's Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Around 500 people, including students, school staff members, and other people from surrounding areas attended the event, which was held at the school's premises in Chigumula area. The party included gifts, some time with Santa Claus, and a dancing showcase by the students themselves. The school management told VOA that this is a tradition the school has been doing for its students since it started 13 years ago. Luke Disho is the director for the school.
It's very, very important for us to celebrate Christmas because our children don't have parents, they don't have families, they stay with an old grandmother or distant uncle or aunt at home, and they're not able at home to celebrate and to have a party and to have, you know, a little bit of sweet and cake for the children. So we want a happy day for the children to celebrate the spirit of Christmas. And it's also a way for our children to learn to give.
Disho, who is also an honorary consul for France in Malawi, said before the main event, the patrons were also treated to a nice meal from the students.
We had a big, big lunch, we call it big lunch, with goat meat and rice and sima, of course, and vegetables. And those are our students themselves who cooked the meal for everybody, for over 500 people.
Eda Zimba is one of the students who entertained the patrons with a dancing style.
The celebration was really cool, and I don't even know how to express it because I've enjoyed myself, I've ate, and now I'm here to dance. And what have interested me very most is the gifts that we have received, the puffs, the biscuits, the squash, and the dance.
She told VOA that she thanks the school's management for hosting the Christmas party to the learners who in most cases do not have Christmas parties in their respective homes. Another student, Emmanuel Chisali, said good meal aside, the event has taught him the spirit of sharing.
Actually, this has brought a change in my life. I've learned that we have to have the heart of sharing one another, as the Father Christmas was doing.
Founded in 2002, Jacaranda School for Orphans is the only school in Malawi which provides free primary, secondary, and tertiary education to orphans. A Malawian woman, Marie Da Silva, started the school after she returned from the United States, where she spent 19 years working as a nanny. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Once again, the festive end-of-year season has rolled around. Across Central Africa and Cameroon in particular, Christmas 2014 is not so merry for some households. From Douala, Interyiki Divine Jr. reports that the soaring cost of living, a scarcity of Christmas goods, and armed conflict have spoiled the feast for thousands.
No,
I'm strolling along the streets of Cameroon's largest city and economic nerve center, Douala. As usual during this time of the year, Christmas carols are blaring from roadside speakers, and flanking me are window shoppers contemplating what to take home to their folks for this year's commemoration of the birth of the biblical Savior, Jesus Christ. The majority of those I speak with, however, say this year a scarcity of toys, decorations, and other articles have sent prices going through the roofs. For instance, Chinese-made toy laptops, which sold for about $5 last year, now cost $8. Those deploring the price hikes, like Winifred Mbibu, blame the snail-paced retrieval of containers with imported Christmas goods from the Douala seaport.
Those prices are so high. So this year is very expensive. Things are very expensive. Yes. Whether maybe when those containers will come, maybe prices will change. But for the moment, prices are so high.
Importers are pointing fingers at cumbersome red tape and corruption by customs officials at the Douala seaport, the largest in Central Africa, which serves landlocked Chad and the war-torn Central African Republic. They say imported containers have been abandoned by merchants who cannot pay huge customs duty charges and amounts required to bribe officials. Back in the streets and markets, vendors wise enough to have stockpiled supplies in time for the feast complain buyers are in short supply. Makin Difo, a dealer in toys and decorative items including artificial Christmas trees, says he is confounded.
This end of here, we don't have people who want to come to buy. We think that there are not money in Cameroon. We don't know what is happening. We have goods, but we don't have somebody to buy. We don't know.
Across the country, 75% of school leavers head on straight for the unemployment pool, according to government statistics. The unemployed join in grumbling over poverty, meager salaries, and belated payouts.
With the bad situation and with the level of the family, it is difficult to satisfy everyone. You know, we have a larger family to take care of, and it's not at all easy right now.
This man, a family head requesting anonymity, tells me that as a result of endemic poverty, the extended family notions of sharing and reunions are fading as household spending contracts. Elsewhere and up in the predominantly Muslim north, reports indicate residents, including those from Christian communities, are neither venturing out nor indulging in any celebrations for fear of Boko Haram attacks. And a similar ambience prevails in the eastern part of the country, where there are recurring fatal incursions by rebels from the Central African Republic. For VOA News, I'm Tariq Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
The battle against Ebola does not end when a patient survives the virus. I am Dr. Conde Greaves. Many survivors return home to their villages only to face stigma based on fear and ignorance. We must fight against stigma and welcome Ebola survivors back into our communities. They are no longer contagious and pose no threat to you. Thousands of orphan children also need your support. Imagine losing your mother and father to Ebola. Their tragedy is often compounded by rejection and isolation when they return home. This is wrong. They are not sick. We must welcome orphan children back into our communities. They have suffered enough. We must also respect our healthcare workers. Many have given their own lives so that others may have a fighting chance. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Somalia's parliament approves a new prime minister today. Pirates hijack a naval gunboat on a major waterway in Nigeria's oil-rich Bayelsa state. And an African Union official talks about efforts to guarantee free and fair elections. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia and part three of our feature series on eradicating trachoma in Ethiopia. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand an award-winning distance runner tops your sports report.
Kim, he was born in Eritrea, but long-distance runner Meb Keflezighi will be remembered as one of the big American sporting heroes of 2014. The 39-year-old Keflezighi moved here to the USA with his family when he was 12 years old. After earning All-American honors at Chaka Sali's alma mater, the University of California at Los Angeles, or UCLA, Meb has had a very successful international career. He won a silver medal for the United States in the men's marathon at the 2004 Athens Olympics. In 2009, Meb won the men's title at the New York City Marathon. And earlier this year, on April 21st, Meb became the first American male in 31 years to win the Boston Marathon. He capped an outstanding year by winning the 2014 Jesse Owens Award, presented by USA Track and Field to the top American male athlete. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2014, let's listen in again to a phone interview my colleague Douglas the Mighty Mpuga did with Meb Keflezighi. Douglas reached Meb in San Diego, California, and he began by congratulating him on winning the Jesse Owens Award.
Well, thanks, Doug. It's a great honor to be, you know, on the same wavelength as the Jesse Owens, the great Jesse Owens, and to be nominated or actually win the Athlete of the Year for the NSA Track and Field is huge, and with also Jenny Simpson, who's also the female version of the Jesse Owens, which is the Jackie Joyner Kersey Award, so I'm on great company.
Yeah, this is a very great achievement. How do you feel?
Well, it's a great honor to be able to say, you know, be called the Athlete of the Year, because the United States is such a great, the number one team. All disciplines, all different events is very strong. You have throwers, you have sprinters, you have jumpers, you know. You have middle distance, long distance, and to be recognized because of my effort at winning the Boston Marathon and finishing fourth at the New York City Marathon. And to be named first time in 2000 in about 12 years, a marathoner to be Athlete of the Year is a huge, huge accomplishment. I feel proud and honored.
Yes, so as you say, you won the 2014 Boston Marathon, being the first American in 31 years. You won the 2009 New York City Marathon, again being the first American since 1982. What motivates you, Meb?
What motivated me is to get the best out of myself. You know, I feel blessed to, I was born in Eritrea and came to Italy, lived in Italy for a year and a half, and then to the United States in 1987. I've been in the United States for 27 years now. And, you know, I never was a runner when I was in Eritrea because of the opportunities, but my physical education class in seventh grade started all that my talent, that my God-given talent, that it was there. And I had great mentors and advisors to help me nurture that talent, and now stand with you, you know, 27 years later, and to still be motivated to get the best out of myself. And in the process, there's been a lot of great achievements, but this one, winning the Boston Marathon in 2014 and to be named Athlete of the Year for USA Track and Field is such a huge honor. And, you know, we all have different talents, different abilities, as long as we pursue our passion, and I feel that I have done that. And you never know, the future is not guaranteed, but you work the hardest and do the best that you can, and everything usually works for the best. And never thought I would be where I am at 39. Maybe, you know, just see Owens Award, I was hoping to get it, potentially work hard to get it in 2005, 2006. But to do it almost 10 years later is just beyond my imagination. But it's all in God's time, and just do the best you can every time, and the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah, maybe as you say, you won the Boston Marathon almost when you're almost 39, beating the strongest field in the race history. Do you intend to continue competing? What are your future plans? Could you share?
Yeah, I mean, my future plan is I'm 39 now. Hopefully, you know, about less than a year and a half now for the 2016 Olympic trials is in L.A. in 2016 in February. And I hope I'll be in good health and condition and see if I can make my fourth Olympic team. I've been very honored to represent the United States in three Olympic teams in 2000, 2004, where I also won silver medal after 28 years for the United States. And then Beijing Olympics, unfortunately, because I had pelvic fracture and I couldn't even walk. I have to crawl like a baby to move one place to another. But I worked very hard on therapy and came back and ran a personal best. I'm still running my best time ever and made the 2012 Olympics. And now see if I can make one more Olympics in 2016. And, you know, I'll be 41 if I'm fortunate enough to make the team.
Yes, lastly, Meb, what advice would you have for upcoming young athletes?
Well, my advice to young, athletes or any person that is trying to achieve great things, things don't happen overnight. You know, success takes time, makes progress, and as long as you are working hard toward the goal, you know, you need to have short-term goal, but also don't lose sight of what the big goal is, you know. And for me, Beijing, I thought it was going to be my peak period to be able to perform my best and try to get another medal or gold medal, but you don't always get what you want, but don't give up on your passion and your dreams. And sometimes you can want it so bad you really want to achieve it, but there's going to be bumps on the road. But if you know that down in your heart that you can believe you can achieve it, never have somebody tell you can't do it. And because you're the one that's doing the work day in, day out, and keep the faith and make progress, more progress, and to hopefully bigger goal.
That's Meb Keflezighi, the 2014 Boston Marathon champion and Jesse Owens Award winner. And Meb was talking by telephone from San Diego, California, with my Voice of America colleague, Douglas the Mighty Mpuga. As I mentioned earlier, Meb went to UCLA, the same school attended by another VOA colleague, Shaka Sali.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart... Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Ed Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Thanks, Ed. And keep on rocking during the holidays and in 2015. Another long-distance runner making a name for himself in 2014 was Kenya's Dennis Kimeto, who smashed the world record for the marathon on September 28th in Berlin, Germany. The 30-year-old Kimeto became the first athlete to break 2 hours and 3 minutes for the marathon distance. He hit the tape in the German capital in 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. In another sunny side of sports highlight for 2014, let's listen in again to the post-race interview Dennis did with the energetic Andy Edwards. Here's Andy.
We're talking with a man who's just made marathon history, Dennis Kimeto, who has won the BMW Berlin Marathon 2014. Not only has he won it, not only has he broken the world record, he is the first man ever to break 2 hours and 3 minutes for the marathon. Dennis, first question, very simple. How does it feel to make history in the marathon?
I'm feeling good for this race. For now, I am happy for world record.
Is this a dream for you? You know, you've only been running for, 6 years? Is it a dream come true?
Yeah, but now it's running for just 9 marathon. But I am happy and I expected to put again world record.
In the race, did you think, were you confident that you could break the world record?
Yeah, in the race, I will see the people inside. He was cheering me, but then I think he was, mine was it. I put the world record.
You know, people have talked, when will 2 hours, 3 minutes be broken? And most people thought, well, a few years away, not now. But for you, you seem so relaxed and confident about it. Is that true, that your training was so good that you thought you could do this?
Yeah, after that come here, I training good.
Just one more question, Dennis. You're now the world record holder. Do you think, and you're still quite young, do you think, especially in your running career, do you think you can break the world record again?
Yeah, I expected to run record again. Maybe next year I can come here to put again the world record.
Well, fantastic. I think all of us just stand back in awe of what you've achieved. Dennis Kimeto of Kenya, the new world record holder and champion of the BMW Berlin Marathon 2014. Dennis, fantastic day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As the year draws to a close, another Kenyan athlete, Rita Jeptu, could lose her 2014 Boston Marathon women's title after testing positive for a banned substance. Athletics Kenya says it will hold a hearing about Jeptu's drug case in early January. Jeptu is a 3-time winner of the Boston Marathon and a 2-time winner of the Chicago Marathon. She's one of the highest-profile Kenyan athletes to fail a doping test. Kenyan officials say Jeptu's samples showed traces of the blood and endurance booster EPO, the same performance enhancer taken by disgraced American cyclist Lance Armstrong. Rita Jeptu with a dark cloud hanging over her at the end of 2014, while Dennis Kimeto, the sun shines as the world record holder. And with that sun shining, this is VOA's Sonny Young saying, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Wow, Sonny, I need my sunglasses. All right. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC. Right here on The Voice of America. Well, in part three of our feature series on fighting trachoma in Ethiopia, we'll visit Wolosso, where an NGO works to improve the lives of people with disabilities. And Kenya celebrates migrants. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Yehune Bele of Ethiopia with Sagalila. We'll be right back. Yohoni Bele with Zegalila. While 1 billion people in the world have disabilities and 80% of them live in developing countries, Light for the World, a confederation of development NGOs, partners with international and local organizations to provide the disabled with community-based rehabilitation services, help that is sustainable and inclusive. I visited Wolliso, Ethiopia, where Light for the World and its partners empower families to achieve life-changing goals. The Vision Community-Based Rehabilitation Association in Wolliso reports that 421 children with disabilities received rehabilitation at home this year. The numbers are impressive, but even more so are the children behind those numbers. 12-year-old Misakir Yusuf eagerly greeted me with a wide smile. She sat in her wheelchair with schoolwork in front of her. 3 years ago, this scene did not seem possible for Miss Akir. She was born with cerebral palsy, a disorder caused by a brain defect that occurs before birth. It causes impaired mobility, involuntary movements, and learning disabilities. Miss Akir's parents did not know why their child was different from others. They fought a lot, and Miss Akir's father eventually left the family. Miss Akir's life improved when Abinesh Zawalda worked with Miss Akir's mother and others in the community to change their negative attitudes towards Miss Akir's cerebral palsy. Abinesh is a field service worker who came into Miss Akir's life through a partnership with Light for the World and Wolliso's community-based rehabilitation.
And when we found her, she was not like this. We found her when lying position in a difficult situation. In the first place, before we start rehabilitation service, we did engagement letter with the mother on the overall rehabilitation process that this child will receive. Following that, we started our rehabilitation program with community education program to teach the parent on the rehabilitation process, even to teach neighbors about the general condition of this child with disability. At the beginning, it was a really bad situation. So to change that sanitation and hygiene problem, issue, they start, discussing with the mother and with the neighbor.
Light for the World and its local partners in Wolliso highlight the importance of educating the entire community where the child with disabilities lives. In doing this, misconceptions about disabilities disappear and are replaced with support and compassion.
The mother was completely hopeless because she even think that this kind of disability is, not common with others. She was thinking that this is the only challenge that her child is experienced. And she was totally outcasted and stigmatized by neighbors. Even the mother herself segregated herself from others. Because of the coffee ceremony, now things have changed and the situation is now good.
Coffee ceremonies are a major social event in Ethiopian social and cultural life. They are also a platform for practical solutions to real-life challenges for mothers of children with disabilities. The social event becomes a formal meeting, usually held at the home of a parent of a disabled child. Information is exchanged and experiences are shared. It is a time to show support and understanding, a time to educate the community about disabilities.
Her disability is physical disability. When I found her, she can't use her hands, It was like this position. Her head is, you know, turned on the right position. She doesn't use her upper extremities and her lower extremities. And it was a severe physical disability.
Through home-based rehabilitation, Ms. Akir now has a wheelchair and attends school. She is able to help her mother sell goods in town, and with continued community-based rehabilitation, she will continue to improve both physically and mentally. Light for the World supports community-based rehabilitation projects worldwide. In 2013, they report over 59,000 children with disabilities were able to access their programs. Well, Kenya is host to numerous refugees seeking safe haven from conflict. Immigrants from Somalia face challenges in their new lives in Kenya, and Kenya celebrated their immigrants on a special day in December. Lenny Ruvaga has more news from the Kenyan capital.
22-year-old Ahmed Shakie runs a clothing business in Eastleigh, on the outskirts of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. 4 years ago, he and two friends combined their resources to import clothes from Dubai and China and sell them at a profit. Their thriving enterprise draws in customers from all over the area. What's notable about their success is the fact that Shakie is a Somali refugee. He fled Mogadishu 7 years ago, but says he plans to return someday to rebuild his country.
Somalia, there's fighting always. There are terrorists, and it isn't a peaceful place. It is not a place to live. Now that we are here in Kenya, we live and work here. When Somalia becomes peaceful, we will go back home.
Eastleigh, or small Mogadishu, is home to thousands of Somali migrants. Most who have attained legal status are either second or third generation Kenyan Somalis. Journalist Asaid Hassan fled the Hodan district in Somalia in 2006 at the height of the Al-Shabaab insurrection. Hassan worked at Horn Africa Radio, which was taken over by extremists. Today, Hassan works at Star FM, which is based in Eastleigh. The radio station covers Kenya and parts of Somalia. He says he and other Somalis face similar challenges living in Kenya.
Number one is the ethnic profiling. Also, there is a lack of documentation. We have come here for so long, and we have a problem of getting the proper IDs in Kenya. And when we come across to the police, they ask us ID. Well, we don't have it.
2 weeks ago, the International Organization for Migration, or IOM, in collaboration with UNHCR, began the voluntary repatriation of 94 Somali refugees from Kenya, 23 years after conflict and famine drove them from their homeland. The process is supported by Somalia. Michael Pellinger, the senior operations officer and programs coordinator, says the refugees are provided humane treatment.
Well, IOM, along with other partners such as UNHCR, the government of Kenya and other organizations, ensures that refugees that are coming into Kenya have all the adequate services available to them in relation to their concerns or whether in transit, or whether they are for a given period of time allowed to stay in Kenya until their situation is resolved.
As the world marks International Migrants Day on December 18th, IOM is looking towards its post-2015 development plan to ease the poverty of the migrants in Kenya. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most serious threats to public health today is antimicrobial resistance, or the ability of disease-causing microorganisms to develop immunity to medications that are designed to kill them. This is particularly true of tuberculosis, or TB. TB kills about 1.3 million people each year and is the leading cause of death among people living with HIV in Africa. In most cases, TB is treatable and curable. However, people with TB can die if they do not get proper treatment. TB is usually treated with a 6 to 9 month course of several antibiotics. If the wrong or poor quality antibiotics are prescribed, or a patient does not or cannot complete the full course of treatment, the bacteria may develop resistance to the medication. Multidrug-resistant TB, or MDR-TB, has developed a resistance to the two most potent TB drugs. As a result, medications to treat MDR-TB are scarce. According to the World Health Organization, as many as 500,000 new cases of MDR-TB occur worldwide, with hundreds of thousands of people dying from the disease. In an effort to help fight MDR-TB, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has formed a new public-private partnership with Janssen Therapeutics, a subsidiary of the Johnson & Johnson Company. Janssen has developed betaquiline, the newest member of a class of antibiotics which is effective against MDR-TB. This is a breakthrough achievement in TB drug discovery and the first of its kind to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration in nearly 50 years. To make betaquiline more accessible, USAID and Janssen signed a memorandum of understanding under which Janssen will donate $30 million worth of the medication over 4 years. For its part, USAID will work with its country partners, national TB programs, and with Janssen to ensure responsible access and appropriate use of the treatment. USAID remains committed to addressing the growing concern around antibiotic-resistant bacteria as outlined in President Obama's executive order and supporting introduction and appropriate use of new drugs to fight MDR-TB, said USAID Administrator Dr. Rajiv Shah. This collaboration will bring new hope to MDR-TB patients in need of better treatment options.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.